We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Good afternoon, Hamilton. This is Hamilton Today. Scott Radley sitting in for Scott Thompson today. This is Scott's monthly chest waxing day, so he's out for a few hours. I don't think that's really it. I don't know. Scott had to take the day off. I will be here. Hope everything is well. He'll be back tomorrow, but welcome to the show. Glad you're along. If you are having your chest waxed as you listen to us, bon chance, I guess. I don't know how many people. How many people do you think over the years have listened to this particular show while having the hairs on their chest ripped out by hot wax? I'm guessing the number would be quite small. But you never can tell. Maybe there is a chest waxing clinic somewhere in the city. Are they a clinic? Spa, I guess, is probably more. I don't know if it's a clinic, although you might need a clinic after going through that procedure. Maybe there's a place that plays us. And if that's the case, hey, how are you? Glad you're listening. If you can hear us over the screams, that's even better. Welcome to the show. As I say, we are glad you are along with us today. We have a jam-packed show. Will, the producer, has been busy lining stuff up. We have got a great show today. A lot of really interesting things, including a little bit of sad news. You've just heard on the news there that just within the last few hours, we've heard that Bob Cole, who for generations was the voice of hockey in this country, and truly for many, many people, you would hear Bob Cole and it would sound like hockey. I mean, I know there's a lot of great play-by-play people today and they do a terrific job, but you know, there's a sound. To me, and maybe for some of you listening, when Dick Irvin came on the air, it sounded like the Montreal Forum. When Foster Hewitt was largely, primarily before my time. So for me, when I hear the voice of Foster Hewitt, I think of the 1972 Canada-Russia Summit Series and Paul Henderson scoring. That to me, you hear Foster Hewitt's voice, that's what comes to mind for me. Bob Cole, for generations of people, the voice of hockey in this country. Brian McFarlane, the Hockey Night in Canada legend, hockey historian, inventor, creator of Peter Puck, although we won't be talking about that today. He's going to join us a little later on in the show to talk about Bob Cole and his impact on the game. We will we'll get to that, as I say, in the 4 o'clock hour. We will be talking, for better or for worse, but it's for worse, about what happened with the Leafs last night. If you're a Leaf fan, that's all I got to say about that. I'll let my guest handle the intelligent and constructive words. I'll just stick with because that's what it felt like yesterday. If you're a Leaf fan, really, again, we'll get to that this hour. We're going to be talking about space tourism. Would you go on a balloon powered space glamping escapade? Which I don't know that those five words have ever been uttered in the same sentence before, but there you go. There's where we are. It's 2024. Space glamping. I thought glamping was ridiculous enough. Now it's space glamping. But this is apparently a thing that's coming. We'll figure out what that's all about later on. A big story today in the city of Hamilton that is underway as we speak, the discussion at the Police Services Board about Hamilton police officers wearing body cameras. We'll get to that. I don't know if by the time we talk about it in the 4 o'clock hour, I don't know if we'll have an answer yet to how that vote has gone, but we're going to talk about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing that we would be introducing this. It sounds like we're going to be. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? That police officers would have body cameras. It's going to cost money, but presumably you would then be able to say, yes, but we're going to get rid of either bad cops misbehaving or people making allegations about cops that aren't true. I would think that would just take away all the mystery and we could look at it with the full context and probably an awful lot of time and energy that we spend now trying to sort out whether the cop was in the wrong or the person was in the wrong. It would be pretty easy to solve if we have this, right? Well, we'll get to that one. You may not need a sick note anymore to stay home from work, not to go to work. You don't need a sick note to go to work. Maybe some places, maybe if you're a lab rat for a test of some kind. They want you to be sick, but everywhere else. No, you may not need, the government is, the provincial government is looking into removing the idea that you have to have a sick note. Again, good idea or bad idea? I guess it depends if you're the employee or the employer, perhaps, but we'll be talking about that this hour or in this show. Jamesville development. Here's one that we're going to get to. And, you know, I'm going to have to dig a little deeper into this before the day is out. But there is a new play that is being produced called The Last Timbit, a Tim Hortons-inspired stage production. The Last Timbit. All I can picture is this stuffed mascot-like round object with two legs singing some sad song about being the last Timbit. It's like Kermit singing It's Not Easy Being Green, only it's not easy being old-fashioned plain and left in the bottom of the Tim Hortons box when all the delicious honey glazed and chocolate dip have been and strawberry filled have been consumed and nobody likes me because I'm old-fashioned plain and stale. And these are the ones that when someone drives through the drive-thru with a pet dog and the people, they give the old-fashioned plains. They know that no human wants to eat them. You know, man, you know what? As I'm talking about this, maybe there's a real moving experience in The Last Timbit. A deep dive into the battered and beleaguered psyche of old-fashioned plain Timbits that are left at the end of the day on the shelves in Tim Hortons when all the popular Timbits have been claimed. And maybe we can look at this as a symbol of our lives. And the album, the soundtrack, will go on to become a bestseller among those who have been the last one picked in pickup hockey games over the years. Actually, no, the more I talk about it, the more ludicrous it sounds. Anyway, we're going to talk about this stage production. Would you go? Would you pay good money? I'm sure it comes with a coffee and Timbits. I mean, how could you watch this without? But would you pay good money to go watch a play called The Last Timbit? I don't know. We'll talk about that one.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Starts with an earthquake, birds, snakes, and airplanes.
Hamilton today here on 900 CHML. Scott Radley in for Scott Thompson. The first line of that song, the first half of the first line is what Leaf fans are saying. The second half, not so much. It is the end of the world, they are saying, and I feel fine. I do not think so. My next guest, a renowned Leaf fan, who works on this station from 5:30 till 9 in the morning, but I am guessing probably would have preferred just to pull the covers over his head and wallow in misery this morning. His name is Rick Zamperin. How are you, sir?
I am okay.
Are you? Are you? Do we need to talk before, you know, we get into this? Do we need to have an intervention?
I am only okay because I know there are at least a couple of games left in the series, so I'm not sure if there's going to be more than that, but I'm okay with that for the time being.
I watched last night, and it is just so, this team, this Maple Leafs team is so frustrating because they have talent, and that's never been in question. They have talent, and they have even now brought a level of grit that we haven't seen. That one shift where Guy Bruins were just being battered all over the place was like back to the old Wendell Clark days. But whatever it is, no matter what the ingredients they put together, they still seem to not be able to figure out a way to properly handle the Boston Bruins.
This is the most convoluted puzzle, if you're a Leafs fan, to decipher. It's like one of those, remember those 3D images you'd have to squint your eyes at and kind of look at, and you figure out the image in the middle? This is the Maple Leafs in a nutshell, because you think you've figured them out, but you haven't quite, and probably will never be able to do so. I do have some takeaways over the first three games of this series, and let's not get into the Leafs Bruins of the past, because, well, that's in the past. We don't want to dig that up, but there is definitely a dark and dreary past for the Maple Leafs. But in these three games, I think the Leafs have played well enough to win at least two of them. They do have one win, In game one, they clearly did not show up as I was expecting them to do so. In game two, they played much better and deservedly, I thought, you know, earned that victory. And then last night, I thought they played well enough to win. And it was, you know, Brad Marchand coming back to, you know, haunt Maple Leafs fans and some of the Leafs on this team and scoring two big goals, including a massive goal right after Todd Bertuzzi had tied the game in the third period. And, you know, aside from that, you know, they were physical. They were creating turnovers, cycling the puck down low. Transition game was good. Samsonov looked solid. And that was all good. The biggest factors for me is, number one, Jeremy Swayman certainly has Toronto's number. I don't think he's lost them, like, ever. And number two, and we knew this going into the series, special teams. Toronto's power play, really since February, has been non-existent and is 1-for-11 in this series. And their penalty killing might be even worse. They've allowed 5 goals on 10 power play opportunities to Boston. And that's why they're down 2-1.
You know, one thing I have not heard anyone say, Rick, and I'm kind of surprised by this, and around here, you know, it might be more difficult to say because we like the guy. He was the coach of the Hamilton Bulldogs for a while, but Guy Boucher is the guy who runs the special teams for the Leafs. And they, as you say, have been awful. And I've heard almost nobody saying anything, saying, what is Guy Boucher doing? But how do you possibly look at his work this year and say it's anything other than a failure?
Well, I mean, the only kind of pass that he would get in that regard is that they were the top power play unit for a few months. And certainly in February, I mean, they're almost at 50%, which is mind-boggling. I mean, half the times they would go on the power play, the puck would be in the back of the opposition's net. And usually the top unit, I think Tampa Bay, the top unit at about 25%. So add 25% more than that. And that's how good this power play was in February. But a few months later, it has been one of the worst in the NHL. And that's putting teams like San Jose and Chicago and Anaheim, the bottom dwellers of this league, even ahead of the mighty Maple Leafs, you know, $10 trillion contract power play.
Yep.
I can't put my finger on it. I'm sure if this series ends early and the Leafs special teams continues to dwindle, Mr. Boucher is probably going to be looking for a new place of employment. That's just the way the world works
in
pro sports.
And saying that it was once great, you know, once upon a time, I had a lush head of hair. Well, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day because there's nothing left there now. So it's let's go back to Brad Marchand for a second, because as much as you know, after the game, Sheldon Keefe was talking, and I think he hit on something that, you know, it sounds like it's sour grapes probably, but I think he's onto something. I am trying to figure out how it is that Brad Marchand does what Brad Marchand does. You watch on, they show the highlights, he commits infraction after infraction after infraction, and yet the referees don't call him, to the point that his coach was saying, oh, you know, he doesn't commit any infractions. No, he does. They don't call him. And I've never understood why the refs, knowing that he's doing this, don't watch. Most guys, what was his name, who got traded to Carolina, who was the winger for Matthews last year for a while, when he was diving, they would call him all the time for diving or not call a penalty. But Marchand seems to have this magical way to not get called for stuff. How?
It's a head-scratcher for me, because usually when you get a reputation for doing things, I mean, he's been suspended before. He's done some things on the ice where he's been penalized for, and he has done it for a long time. So whenever he's on the ice, I think the officials, you would think, would be, ultra sensitive to the possibility of something shady happening. I mean, he's licked guys' faces. He has, literally, you know, been suspended for, you know, unruly behavior on the ice. And here's a guy who last night, there was a couple of times where you would think, okay, that should be a penalty. I mean, we know what the standard is. Why wasn't that called? And for him to consistently be given whatever grace that is, I just can't believe it. And to see it over and over again, you expect the referee's arm to go up to signal the penalty, nothing happens. And I think even him, to a certain extent, is like, okay, I can push the line a little bit further, and on it goes.
Yeah, you're right about the reputation thing, because other guys get a reputation, and that means they get more calls against them. He gets a reputation, and it's less calls against him, and it is a head-scratcher. One more thing before we go, and we're short on time. I didn't hear the broadcast last night, but I had a couple people texting me saying, I'm listening on the radio to the game, and Joe Bowen is just excoriating the Toronto fans for being quiet, for not... What do you think about the play-by-play guy of the team calling out the fans for essentially being a bunch of white-collar, sushi-eating, not-cheering, doing-nothing, pay-the-bills-but-not-helping-your-team folks? What do you think?
I think it's perfectly fine. He has earned his right to do so. He's been doing it for 40 years or whatever it is. This is not the first time he's done it, but I believe this is the first time he's done it after a playoff game. I think Joe's frustrated. I think he is relaying the frustration of the blue-collar Leaf fans and how they want to wake up the others, the suits, the corporate crowd at Scotiabank Arena. I'm very interested to see if Joe's message got through and what the reaction is on Saturday.
Yeah, Winfield wants noise. Remember, Winfield wants noise, and then yes. Blue Jay fans went crazy, and you look at Winnipeg, you look at Edmonton, you look at Vancouver, the places are rocking, and you come to Toronto, and it's like halfway through the first period, half the seats in the lower bowl are still empty. I get his point. I do get his point. I just don't know there's any way to fix it unless you drop ticket prices by 80% or 800%, and I don't know about you, but I don't see that happening.
No, not at all.
That is Rick Zamperin. He is now going to go back. And actually, no, he's not going to go back and crawl under the covers and mope the NFL draft just tonight. He's going to be up all night watching the NFL draft and then on here at 5:30 tomorrow morning, bright and chipper. Thanks for doing this.
Can't wait. Have a good one.
Now, I don't know how many of you have $165,000 lying around burning a hole in your pocket. And if you do, you may be one of those more concerned with your capital gains than anything else to spend it on. But if you have $165,000 and you are thinking, you know what I'd like to do with that? I'd like to go to space. Well, we may have an opportunity for you. There's a company called Halo Space, that is saying by 2026, it is going to be offering stratospheric balloon glamping. This high-tech, super modern hot air balloon, essentially, is going to take you up to the edge of the atmosphere where you can sit in comfy reclining chairs in a pod with giant windows and look over Earth and have high-end dining. Sounds kind of cool, doesn't it? Let's bring in Orbax. He is a science communicator with the University of Guelph. Sarbax, how are you today?
Good. How are you doing today, Scott?
I am fantastic. So what kind of market do you think there is out there for people to go space glamping?
Well, I'm guessing, I'm just going to throw this out there. Probably not me, probably not you, and probably not most of your listeners. They're going to have the $160,000 to just toss on to going up and checking out what the upper stratosphere looks like. But I mean, there's a market there. These companies like Virgin Galactic, who are going much, much higher and are much more expensive, are... they're big companies and they're planning to sell this to what I would assume are just Instagram influencers and YouTubers.
See, the thing I thought about this one, and it's a little bit different from the other ones because it's not a rocket, it's a balloon with a pod. The pod, I'm sure, is very expensive to build, the initial build, but I could easily see in time the price of this thing coming down. No, once you've paid the thing off, and I mean, $25,000, let's say, I'm just throwing out a number, is still $25,000. It's still a lot of money. But you make it now 25 instead of 165, and I think you would have a lineup.
Well, and that's fair to say. I mean, I think the big issue that you have with something like this is kind of what you define as being where outer space is. 35 kilometers isn't very far. I mean, that's more or less a shorter distance. I'm sitting in my backyard in Guelph right now. You're in Hamilton. It's less than a distance between us right now. So space technically starts at about 100 kilometers up from the Earth. So you're only going up 35, which would take you up into the stratosphere. At that point, for something like that, you can use those hot air balloons, those weather balloons. You don't need a rocket to get up that high.
Yeah, and what would you, I mean, I'm looking at an image here. Obviously, it's a generated image in a piece of art, but it shows you looking at the globe, the curvature of the globe. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that what you would see? Is this a faked picture? I mean, it's a faked picture, but you know what I mean? Like, is this realistic about what you would see?
Well, yeah, you would see the curvature of the Earth. You wouldn't be able to see the entire globe, but you would definitely be able to see that edge and that curvature. You know what? I looked up because this reminded me of the story of Felix Baumgartner. Do you remember Felix Baumgartner? A few years back,
remind me.
He did the highest skydive.
Oh yes, ever. Yeah.
And that was from 39 kilometers up. So he was only about 5 kilometers higher than this balloon would take him. He did it the same way with these balloons that took him up to that height where he jumped. And that's all out there on YouTube. So if you want to go check out Felix Baumgartner's jump from YouTube, you'll be able to see what you would see at that point in space.
I'm just waiting for the first person who wants to do the 35-mile high club. That you're going to sell tickets for. Somebody's going to ask.
Look at it, that pod was pretty small, so I don't know if you'd be able to sneak away, really.
One of the things when I also saw this story and was reading about this, and I wonder, I mean, you're a guy who spends a lot of time thinking about space, and I don't know if you've ever wanted to do that, to go up in space, but this is with a hot air balloon, it is a... You know, it's going to be a slow rise till you get there. Mm-hmm. How much would we be missing if it was your dream to go to space? Has it not always been part of the dream to have that blast off with the rocket vibrating and you, or would people be more comfortable with this?
Well, see, you've got that's me exactly to a T. You know, for me, my dream of eventually, you know, being able to go to space includes all of it. It includes the rocket. It includes the G-force. It includes you just being blasted off on effectively a giant bullet to who knows where. Right. but what we're looking at with something like this, which may appeal more to a broader audience, especially when you lower that price point, is effectively a giant Ferris wheel, you know, if you want to put it that way, right? So instead of scaling the side of a building and all the drama and adventure that's associated with that, you get on a Ferris wheel and go the same height, but it's a nice slow sort of rise up into the air.
Any idea, and I didn't see this in the story, it's probably there, any idea how long it would take to get 35, did you say miles or kilometers up?
It's 35 kilometers up, and from what I read, the hot air balloons that they're proposing would rise you at a rate of about 20 kilometers an hour. So it would take you maybe 90 minutes, maybe 2 hours to get up to the height that they're saying.
And
depending on how long the balloon lasts, you might be way faster way down. Who knows?
Well, I was going to say, how do you get down? Like, do they just cut the air and you plummet and then there's a parachute?
Well, I mean, you can do it that way. I don't know. That is one of the ways you can do it. My guess is that they would strategically sort of release the buoyancy from the balloons and you would sort of drop at a lower rate. My guess would be that it would be a slow rise and a slow descent as well.
Yeah, you know, it's such an interesting one because I don't... I mean, obviously, I've never had, like you just said, I've never had the money to even play around with the idea that I would ever go to space. But again, if someone came to me and said, I'll give you a choice, you can either go by rocket with the Virgin, whatever, or you can do this. I can tell you which one my wife would want me to do more because this sounds a whole lot safer. But I don't know. Like I could see if the price came down, I could see there would be an awful lot of executives and,
sure,
you know, who would say, yeah, I'm not going to spend the entire kid's inheritance, but for $20,000, $30,000, I would try this. I could see there being people who would easily do this.
I know. And I mean, you know, at the rate that our real estate's increasing, what's that going to be? 1/100th of what your house costs now?
That's true. Sell the house and go glamping for a while.
Yeah,
up in
but
space.
I mean, it would be pretty interesting. I took a look at those pods too, and it's a nice pod. It would sit, I think it sits like 8 people sort of around in a circle. Like you said, they're trying to put all the bells and whistles on this with the fine dining and what have you. And I mean, you know what? If it was affordable, who wouldn't want to do this?
Yeah, the one thing that seems to be absent is a bathroom, which could be a problem in space.
Yeah, it can be. I mean, my other worry with a lot of stuff like this is this, you know, and it leads from that point somewhat, is this idea of space pollution and space junk. You know, it's one thing to go up and to scientifically send out research pieces and devices and experiments and do them in space to see what the effects of space are or to learn more about our cosmos. It's yet another thing to litter our entire atmosphere with satellites that are just going to stay there for 50, 75 years and then come crashing down in a pile of junk. And I worry with more of the space tourism taking place that you're just going to turn the whole thing into just a pile of garbage.
It's going to be Mount Everest.
Nowhere to go.
Yeah, it's going
to
be Mount Everest. Just before we go, at 35 kilometers, would you be, when you went up, would you then be coming down at the same spot on the Earth, or would you be affected by the rotation so you'd go up in Florida and land in the Sahara?
Yeah, 35 kilometers is not high enough that there'd be really much effect. So you would pretty much be coming up and coming down relatively close. I would assume that they'd be doing this over some sort of body of water so that if anything did go wrong, they'd have splashdown points. But yeah, it's not like with a rocket where you're flinging yourself out so far that you're orbiting the Earth in some way and the Earth is moving beneath you. You'd still be relatively close.
It is. It's fascinating. Sorry, Orbax, really appreciate you taking time to do this. Thank you.
And no problem. It's a really interesting story. Take care and have a fantastic day.
That is a scientastic day. There you go. You can look it up at space.com if you want to see some pictures. Halo Space unveils capsule design for stratospheric space glamping is the headline. Space.com. And they got all kinds of pictures and stuff. You can see it there. Since the federal budget last week in which capital gains were on the agenda, there have been a number of people, many people, who have come out and said, look, those people who own fantastically expensive cottages and have all this income, and the people who are going to be subject to capital gains, more capital gains payments, boo-hoo-hoo. You're all rich and who cares? You know, suck it up. Be happy you've got those things. All right. But it's not all people who are whining and moping who are in that position. There are some very intelligent people, financially, economically intelligent people who are saying, wait a second, hold on. There are some issues with this that we need to consider. One of them is Don Drummond. He is a Stouffer Dunning Fellow in Queen's University. He's a fellow and resident of the C.D. Howe Institute, previously chief economist at Toronto Dominion Bank, associate deputy minister at Finance Canada, writing in the Globe and Mail, writes this, the implementation scheme amounts to market manipulation for insignificant and arbitrary fiscal goals through cynical pre-legislation enforcement. I'm going to bring Don in here to explain because I'm not nearly intelligent enough to understand all this. Don, thank you for doing this today.
Hey, you're welcome.
So what are, as I say, there are people who say, look, if you're affected by capital gains taxes, too bad, you're rich, shut up and go away. But there are other people like yourself who are raising legitimate, intellectual, smart concerns about this. What is your big issue with the way they're doing this?
Well, this started in the Globe and Mail op-ed that you referred to. An editor of the Globe and Mail asked me if I could write a piece on why the government picked June 25, 2024 as the effectiveness date. And I replied back, you think it's a problem that I haven't got a clue? Because I don't have a clue. And they said, well, everybody else is guessing, so guess away. So not only you now have to pay the capital gains on two-thirds of the tax, on two-thirds of the gain as opposed to half before, but it's to become effective in June 25, 2024. So we have 10 weeks. And why did they pick June 25? There's not a word in the budget that would indicate that was the case. It's not because they're waiting for legislation. Well, we'd hope you didn't have to abide by tax rules until there's legislation, but that won't come for a long time after that. I thought maybe it's they feel a bit guilty. This is a form of retroactive taxation. You made your investments on the basis. It's been a half inclusion rate since 2000. So for 24 years, you thought there was a certain set of rules in place and you made your investments. And now retroactively, they're taxing you on those gains. So they may have felt a little bit badly about that. That does allow somebody who has public shares, for example, you can sell those very quickly. But suppose you had real property. You gave the example of a cottage. Pretty hard to list your cottage today and have the sale close. Who knows if you're going to sell? And there's delay. You might have private company shares, and those aren't all that liquid. They're not very easy to dispose of. So I don't know that I don't think any credit should be given to the government for relieving their conscience a little bit about the measure and allowing people to get off the hook. To me, it's just creating chaos. And the thing that really flabbergasts me is there's two small changes they could have made to the implementation that wouldn't have brought on this chaos. One is they still would have got a lot of revenue up front if they'd picked some date in 2024 by later, not June 25th, let's say September, let's say October. If people were going to sell their assets, they still would have done it in this year and the government would collect the revenue. The other part is they could have allowed people to make what is called an elective disposition. Let's suppose you hold some public shares. You don't really want to sell them. You've held it for a long time. It's doing well. You like the dividend stream. If there were not for a tax change, you would never have thought to sell them. So don't sell them, but declare an elective disposition, which means you pay now the accrued tax on that, but you can keep the asset. So you're not disrupting the market. And this is what flabbergasts me. It seems like those two tweaks are very simple. I can't believe the tax experts within finance, and certainly if not in finance, somebody outside wouldn't have advised them. It's almost like they wanted to create chaos, and it's almost like they like it when people complain, because sort of the context you set up, these are the elites, these are the wealthy. But let me just go back to your example of a cottage. I bought the property and built my cottage in 1984. I would pay a very substantial capital gains and would get caught on this, but there actually has been no real gain on it. We do not allow inflation adjustment. So you bought something for $100,000 in 1984. It's worth a lot more than that in today's dollars, but there hasn't been a real gain. You're not any wealthier from that, but you're going to pay a tax. And that's one of the reasons why the inclusion rate was a half, to very crudely offset the fact that we don't allow inflation adjustment.
One of the things that you write in here, and again, I'm hoping I understand what you're saying correctly, is that because we've set this date so early, or because the government has set this date so quickly, that it's going to spur a surge in sell-offs, which will benefit the government, because now even if it's only the 50% capital gains, they will get a surge of those 50% capital gains taxes. But what would be the downside? Why would it be a problem if all kinds of people who had shares or whatever else all sold off really quickly? Why is that not good?
Well, I don't think it's fair to people to force them to do something solely for a tax reason. The example I gave, perhaps you've held a stock for a long time. It's done quite well for you. You like the dividend. It's an important part of your investment strategy. It may be an important part of your retirement plan. You had no intention until this budget came along of selling it anytime soon. Now you're given a strong incentive to sell it right away. Think about it in terms of the economy. If that person sells it from the equity market, they may well go into government bonds, of which there's lots of them around because the governments have got large debt. But you've got now less money in equity and you've got more money in fixed income. And here's the irony that didn't seem to occur to the government. They increased the lifetime capital gains exemption for small business, and they said they did that to encourage risk-taking. But they're forcing people to be less risky on their investments because of this capital gains inclusion. Like, oh, make up your mind. On one hand, you're trying to encourage risk taking. On the other hand, you're shutting it down. And they keep saying it's such a small number of people, but they hold a disproportionate amount of the public shares, and they are funding the innovation and the entrepreneurship in Canada. We can't have it both ways. We can't say they're not that significant, they're a small number, but on the other hand, they hold all these gains and they're not that important. They are important. They're funding a lot of the innovation and entrepreneurship, and they would be likely, if you're taxed higher, to do less of that in future.
That is Don Drummond, Stalford Dunning Fellow at Queen's University, Fellow in Residence, C.D. Howe Institute, many, many, many other things. Don, always appreciate taking time. Thanks for doing this.
Okay. Thank you.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
If you grew up in this country watching hockey on Hockey Night in Canada on Saturday nights, there are voices that just, and we said this off the top of the show, voices that just, as soon as you hear them, they take you to a place. For me, some of them, Dick Irvin, every time I hear Dick Irvin's voice, Hamilton, his dad was from Hamilton, turns out. Dick Irvin, I hear his voice and I am immediately inside the Montreal Forum, right before Roger Doucette sings the national anthem. And other ones, Bob Cole, who just died today, certainly one of those voices, the most distinctive hockey voices. You hear his voice, you know a hockey game is going on. I want to talk about him and his passing today, and we are very fortunate to be joined by yet another one of those voices, because if you grew up watching Hockey Night in Canada in the 60s and 70s and 80s, his voice is right up there with all the other ones. His name is Brian McFarlane, joins us now. Brian, how are you today?
Well, I'm doing well, Scott. I as for voices, mine isn't what it used to be, and it never was what Bob Cole's voice was. That was really a unique voice he was gifted, and he made the best of it. He started after Paul Henderson's goal in 72 on radio, and he gravitated to Hockey Night in Canada for the next 50 years, for God's sake. I thought I was a longtime veteran of that show, but he outlasted most of us, and I was sad to hear about his passing today. And after you called this morning, I read some things on my computer here. If you have a moment.
Of course.
Somehow I associate Bob as the Hockey Night in Canada broadcaster. I might be wrong. If I'm right, I extend my condolences. Oh, I didn't want to read that one. Rest in peace, Mr. Cole. I always enjoyed hearing him call a game, and to me, he was the voice of Hockey Night in Canada. It just hasn't been the same without him. And you could say that about Foster Hewitt or Danny Gallivan, but somehow Bob had a passion for the game unlike others, and he was just revered. And I'm not surprised at all the plaudits that are pouring in recognizing his passing today.
Brian, you know, you said that your voice is not the same. The amazing thing about the most famous hockey broadcasters in this country, though, none of them that come to mind for me, none of them have that rich baritone, you know, beautiful broadcaster voice that you would think would be what would be the best for this. Their voices are all unique, but they're all, I think none of them by themselves would be perfect, but boy, they were perfect for hockey.
Yeah, you word that perfectly. I think when you were talking, I think of Bob shouting, "Oh, baby!"
Yes,
and they're going home when the Russians left the ice in 1976, and we wondered. I was at the game that day, and I ran down to the basement area where everybody was huddling, Clarence Campbell and the coaches, and they were sending. It was a national telecast, and they thought the Russians were just going to quit and leave the ice and go back to their hotel room in the first period. Well, they convinced them to stay, and somebody said they're gonna think of all the money they'll lose if they don't play anymore today. And I was in the middle of it, but I didn't have a microphone. I was just wandering around hoping I had a microphone to report on this. I'm talking about myself now, and I don't mean to do this. This is Bob's tribute, and he was at his best that day, and he handled that situation so well, you know. They're going home. Oh, yeah, they're going home. I can hear him say it today as in his own inimitable style and with the passion that he brought to the game.
One of the things that, those calls, memories like that, moments like that, where there's no way to prepare for it. You don't plan for their going home, because who in the world would have ever imagined that would have been what happened? You can't prepare a script. And it's, I think of Tom Cheek with, you know, Joe Carter's Touch 'Em All, Joe. The great ones in those moments when there is no conceivable possible way that you could have prepared for it, hit it and hit that mark and make that call that we all remember forever.
Yeah, we all wish we could have done that
for yes.
Other broadcasters. And let me tell you about Dave Stubbs. Stubbs is a very well-known journalist for the NHL now. And he went to Newfoundland some time ago, and he got sick on the aircraft going down. And when he landed and got to the hotel, all he wanted to do was go to bed. And the phone rang, and it was Bob Cole. Bob says, "I hear you're in the hotel. I'm coming down to get you." And he hung up. And he said, 5 minutes later, there was Bob in the lobby, and he's meeting me, and he's taking me out to the car. And he took me on a tour of St. John's, and he took me into pubs, and he took me to places where his friends met. I was totally exhausted, and all I wanted to do was go home and go to bed. I couldn't tell him I was feeling so badly. And it's a kind of a humorous story, but it points out how welcoming Newfoundlanders are to people when they come from the mainland. And Dave Stubbs got a toast of a touch of that hospitality that afternoon when he was so ill. And there's Bob showing him around everywhere he could.
Mm. Brian, you are, I would argue you are the hockey historian. There are other people, of course, who have tackled hockey history, but there are very few who are as prolific as you and have covered as much of the history. So let's talk about the history for a sec, but with the broadcasters. You've heard Foster Hewitt. You've worked with Foster Hewitt. You've worked with many of those names. What makes the great hockey broadcast, hockey specifically, what makes a great hockey broadcaster great at that?
Well, in my opinion, and it's just an opinion, if you don't have a passion for the game, you're not going to be at the top of the list. I hate to mention Ward Cornell's name, but he really wasn't a hockey guy. He was a host of Hockey Night in Canada, and he had to learn who Stan Mikita was and Bobby Hull's slap shot and how hard it was and all of those things as he moved along. But if you have a passion for the game and you want to be a broadcaster, then I suggest you go for it. And I've suggested that to some young guys, and they've done quite well. But if you're just sort of passive about hockey and you don't really care whether Matthews has 69 goals or 9 goals, then it's a little different. And it's not easy to work with somebody who doesn't have a vast knowledge of the game or is working on it and gets excited when there's a Stanley Cup goal or an important goal or anything that happens on the ice that's exciting. I firmly believe that, and I think most of the guys had that passion, but a few of them could take it or leave it.
That is the great Brian McFarland. Brian, listen, it is so good of you to take a few minutes today. It is wonderful to hear your voice, and thanks for taking this time.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Thanks for remembering.
That is one of the greats. You know, Bob Cole, absolutely one of the greats. Brian McFarland. It's you know, again, for those who grew up of a certain era watching Hockey Night in Canada, you know, Brian downplays his own voice. That is a memorable, instantly recognizable voice. And unfortunately, today, perfect example, they are getting fewer and fewer. We're losing those voices as time goes by.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
A decision today that was expected or possible at the Police Services Board has been deferred. But the subject that we're going to be talking about that was up on the agenda was whether or not Hamilton police officers should wear body cameras. And this is not, we're certainly not the only place where this discussion has been happening, but for all kinds of reasons, the suggestion has been made that our officers should now be wearing body cameras so that it's all, everything they do, sound and video, is captured and you can see. You can see context, you can see behavior, you can see actions, you can see what police do, you can see what other people do. Now, it comes at a price to fully equip all of Hamilton's police officers with these, and the technology and the system and everything else that goes with it is something in the neighborhood of $15 million. Question is it worth it? Is it a good thing? Is it helpful? Ultimately, is it a fair and a wise investment? Michael Kempa is an associate professor of criminology at the University of Ottawa who joins us now. Thank you so much for the time today.
Always. Thank you.
Okay, my initial thought when I hear this, and I am not a trained criminologist, I'm not a police officer. Thankfully, I'm also not a criminal so far. The cameras on police officers would seem to be something that would protect the public and it would protect the police, and that makes it a win-win, other than the cost, which is expensive. But is there a different argument to be made that these are not good things?
So the upshot on technology is it is an enhancement. It helps policing and accountability if human users use the technology properly.
Okay.
So there's two main things there. Number one, police officers must never turn these cameras off when they enter into controversial situations, which has been known to happen. And the second thing is, as in the United States, police organizations must be very, very liberal in sharing the recordings of controversial events from these cameras after the event. Here in Canada, it's been almost, you have to go through very elaborate Freedom of Information requests to get any body cam footage. That's really not what it's intended to be. If we go down the road of the United States of having these cameras on all the time and liberally releasing the recordings for public accountability, they can be a major benefit.
Okay, two excellent points, and I want to go into both of those because those are, as I say, those are really two things. I was not aware that the officers could turn these off. These devices, they are controllable by the officer, or are they always on and someone back at the station working the system would have that ability?
Well, it's really no different from a cell phone in the sense that it's a piece of equipment on your body. Of course, you can control turning it on or off. There should be a policy developed by the civilian oversight bodies, the police services boards, that would very tightly regulate when they could be turned off. And the answer should be almost never. That's really quite that simple.
Mm. And okay, so on that point, because even as you're saying it, I'm trying to think, well, what would be a reason for you turning it off? What would be a reason an officer would turn off their camera?
I could imagine a situation where an officer were having an interview with either a victim, particularly if the victim is a what you would call a hard-to-reach person, either a youth or somebody who had been the victim of domestic violence. If they requested that the camera be turned off, perhaps in those circumstances in an interview, it could be turned off. But for interactions in the public, pursuing a suspect, a routine roadside check, etc., leave them on.
I can't imagine what the explanation would be for an officer if he or she is out in the public, as you say, in a road stop or something. If their camera went off, what would be the explanation other than it broke? I just can't see what the reason might be, but okay. Okay. The other one about sharing, we do in this country have different, laws around things that, I mean, we watch Dateline NBC or 48 Hours or 2020 or whatever, and there's all kinds of stuff that they have from police interactions that we generally don't ever get released in this country. Should we be going down that path to say, you know what, as a rule, we're going to allow more things, including body camera video, to be out in the public sphere?
Absolutely. And again, that falls on the shoulders of your police services board, the civilian oversight bodies that develop the policies around all of these issues. And the default should always be, if we're investing money in this technology to release the information for public accountability that the technology is intended for, there really ought to be nothing to hide from police organizations when they're interacting with the public and conducting investigations and detentions and arrests and interrogations and so forth. The only thing that we are a little concerned with is there has been a phenomenon observed where, because police officers know they're recording all the time, sometimes they're reluctant to engage controversial situations. So the sort of a hang back mentality, do nothing rather than be recorded. So the way to deal with that is through proper training, and if the police officers understand that even if the recording footage may be controversial, if they're following procedure, they'll be in the right so that they don't hang back. It's something to be aware of, but not a reason not to do it. You train it out.
Do the laws of this country and this province, do they permit the release of this kind of thing? Or are there rules that say you're not allowed to release this information, this video, quickly?
The only rules would be the policies developed by the police organizations themselves, but those policies are developed under the watch and with the approval of the civilian oversight bodies who are there to ensure that the policies are liberal enough to meet the public interest. In a sense, there's really nothing that police organizations can do in terms of operational policies that their oversight police services boards do not approve.
Yeah. And again, I mean, as I started, seems to me that if you are a rogue cop, having this ability for the public to be able to see your behavior, the public should be approving of that, I would think. And if you are a police officer, having these cameras so that someone can't claim you've done something untoward when there is proof that you didn't, you would think the police officers would want this as well. I just, other than the things you pointed out, it would seem that this is a win-win for everybody.
Well, it is. And the culture around recording has certainly changed in the last 15 years since these types of body cams became available on the market. Everybody is recording everything all the time now, and the police themselves are being recorded by citizens on their cell phones at every turn in a phenomenon that sociologists call surveillance, so the opposite of surveillance, people watching you from below. So if you're going to be surveilled, you might as well also record yourself so that your perspective is also recorded. And that is something that the police officers we've spoken to in our research have concern of. They say, all right, I'll wear a camera, but I want it to definitely capture things from my perspective. So let's not have something that's sort of a weird angle
right
from my chest pointing off in one direction. Needs to be what I see through my eyes so people can understand my decision-making process.
There's one other thing, and we're very short on time, but when you talk about how officers are being always recorded now by people's phones, and I agree with you 100%, that happens at stops or whatever else, oftentimes those phones don't start recording until things have accelerated, whereas a body camera would capture presumably the context leading up to it, which would be much more helpful.
100% accurate. And I just point out, it's for the same reason that all of my courses are recorded when we discuss controversial topics to do with protest and war around the world and so forth. If anybody takes what we're saying the wrong way, the entire thing has been recorded. And most police officers look at it in the same way.
Michael Kempa from the University of Ottawa. Terrific talk. Thank you for doing this.
Always. Thank you.
Maybe you are home right now, ill. Hope not. Hope you're feeling fine. But maybe you're at home and you're under the weather and it's day two or day three of this sickness. You're thinking, oh man, I got to go get a doctor's note for work to prove that I'm not just sitting at home watching whatever and wasting time. Well, the Ford government is talking about getting rid of that requirement that you would have to have a doctor's note to prove to your boss that you truly were sick. Good thing? Not good thing. I don't know. Let me bring in Colin DeMello. He is the Queen's Park Bureau Chief for Global News, a man who has never needed a doctor's note because he's never missed a day of work, but he joins us now. Colin, how are you?
Never, not once. I'm healthy as a horse.
And I'm happy to hear that. And I wonder, you know, my first initial reaction of this is, well, that's good. I mean, you know, it's a bit of a pain if you're sick to go to the doctor and to have to go through this. And I'm sure the doctors don't like having to have people tie up their time just to get a note to prove that they're sick. It seems like it's going to be a pretty popular decision, is it not?
Well, yes. I mean, this seems to be a decision that, you know, both helps consumers or, you know, people who are employees, and as well as family doctors. So family doctors have been saying for a long time that they spend a lot of their week on what they believe is unnecessary paperwork. And one of the things they're looking to get rid of are sick notes. They say every single week, about 19 hours of a doctor's week is spent on paperwork, and about 4 hours of that is spent specifically on either writing sick notes or just taking notes down what patients tell them, you know, they're experiencing. And so the province is looking to get rid of these sick notes for, you know, a couple of reasons. One, it makes it a bit easier for the employee or employer to not have this unnecessary burden if somebody's feeling ill. Doctors also say, look, a lot of times the patient might come after the fact for the diagnosis, and that doesn't really make sense. You can't diagnose a patient after the illness is already finished. But from the province's perspective, this really helps with one acute situation. And that's the fact that Ontario doesn't have enough family doctors right now to be able to give everyone access to a family physician. So they're hoping that by eliminating sick notes, it frees up doctors for maybe a couple of hours extra per week. And that means that they can see more patients and take in additional burdens off of, you know, the emergency rooms, because patients who can't see a family doctor go to the ER instead.
And all of that is, I think, makes a ton of sense and hopefully is helpful and hopefully translates into that. Now, what if you are, though, and I'll throw this one out there, even though maybe most people listening don't fall into this category, what about for employers? Because the reason employers have asked for this is because presumably somewhere along the line they were convinced that employees were taking advantage of sick days. What about that? Is there still any kind of checks and balances in place to ensure that your employees are not taking advantage of you?
Yeah. So to get technical about this, what the government is going to be doing is they're going to be changing the Employment Standards Act, which really applies to all employers across the province. And what they are applying this to is the three legislated sick days that every single employee in Ontario is entitled to. Now, your own employer might give you more sick days. They may have a variety of requirements on what you need to prove or not prove in order to take the sick day. But what the province is saying, for the three legislated sick days that you have, the employer will be prohibited from actually asking for a sick note. But they're saying that the employer still retains the right to ask for evidence. So what kind of evidence could you give of your illness? The province is working on some kind of guidance for employers, but some of the examples they gave were an attestation letter. Maybe the employer has a letter that the employee signs to say, yes, indeed, I am sick and I'm not actually faking it. Or the employee could present a receipt. If you had to go to the pharmacy, as an example, to get cough medicine or whatever over-the-counter medication you might have needed, you could present that to your employer instead. So the fine details haven't necessarily all been worked out, but the province is saying that they're trying to come up with some kind of guidance for employers to say, you can still ask for evidence of illness, but you are no longer allowed to ask for a doctor's note related to that illness, so that doctors aren't just being overburdened with this, you know, as a proof of illness kind of mechanism for employers.
So, Colin, will the traditional boss, I'm sick, not count as evidence? Because
Well, I mean, it depends on your employer. But the other side of this is, you know, what's stopping an employee from just heading to the drugstore before heading to the airport for their flight to Vegas, right? You know, go pick up the cough medicine or go pick up the Advil. You know, present that to your boss when you come back after the weekend, but you can take the Friday off to go to Vegas. I mean, certainly anyone who wants to kind of abuse that system will find a way to abuse it, and the vast majority of people will probably be the honest brokers about it. But the province is trying to find that middle ground so that employers who do want proof will be able to get that proof. It's just they don't want that proof to have to be then burdensome to the actual family physician system in this province. We don't have enough family physicians. There's not enough family doctors to go around, and those who are retiring aren't necessarily being replaced at the same rate with new doctors coming into the system. So the province is finding itself in a really tough position, which is why they're doing this less as a, you know, want and more because of a need. They need these family doctors seeing as many patients as possible, because if they're not, people are going to the ER instead. So, you know, it's probably not a perfect system. People are probably going to use it to get around it somehow, as most people would. But at the end of the day, the province says they're trying to kind of, you know, satisfy both the family doctors, the employees, and the employers.
And, you know, the irony of this is that, yes, people will always try to get around it. That's just the reality. But I would argue, I would think that if you have to sign an attestation letter, that puts you in more jeopardy for your job if it turns out that you're lying than if you were to convince a doctor that you were sick and hand over a note because you're saying, I've got a tickle in my throat. You sign something saying, I'm sick, and someone sees you at the airport, you're way more screwed than if you don't have a doctor's note.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly it, right? You know, doctors are very good at their craft, but obviously if somebody walks in and starts saying, I've got this, I've got that, you know, a doctor might be able to say, okay, here's a sick note, go away. An attestation letter might bring a lot more accountability to that situation than anything else. But remember, this is also just for those three legislated days, right? I mean,
yes.
If it goes beyond that, I mean, if you're talking about long-term or short-term disability, if you need a leave of absence, as an example, that isn't changing. The Employment Standards Act will still require that, you know, an employer could ask for some kind of an evidence for why you need this extended leave, and that's where the doctor's note might still come in. So, you know, this is for really the short-term issues that somebody might have, a cough or cold or what have you. They're trying to prevent that, putting that burden onto the doctor, and really creating that accountability mechanism. That's really what they want. And the other piece of this, too, is about artificial intelligence. So the next time you walk into a doctor's office, there's about 150 doctor's offices across Ontario. They're going to start using AI to take their notes. This is a tool that's being used and deployed by the Ontario Medical Association. And, you know, the doctor wouldn't have to, you know, either hand type their notes out or hand write their notes out. They'd use AI. AI scribe is what the province calls it, to take their notes. A lot of people, certainly in the media industry, we use apps all the time to take down notes, but The difference is you're dealing with patients.
Yeah, so they're very different right now. Absolutely.
Yeah, if the patient gives consent, then the doctor can use AI Scribe to take down notes.
That is Colin DeMello. He is the Queen's Park Bureau Chief for Global News. Colin, always appreciate you doing this. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
Housing in this city, if we could get it built, I mean, it is a perpetual battle. And the part of the reason for the battle is because every time it seems, and I know I'm painting with a broad brush here, but every time it seems someone gets an idea, some other interest comes along and says, yeah, but, you know, we've had high rises that there's too many shadows, and we've had this that there's not enough this, and we've had not enough trees and not enough parking. There's always seemingly something. Well, we talk about this because the Jamesville development, which is something that's been going on forever, now sounds like there is hope that maybe this could actually happen. And yet there is a giant but attached to it of, yeah, but. So let me bring in Larry Deani, former mayor of the city of Hamilton. Larry, thanks for doing this today.
Scott, my pleasure.
There is, it seems, always something, isn't there? I mean, and maybe this is the case in every single city, and we are just more hyper-focused on Hamilton. But boy, it seems like so many projects that are proposed get that yeah, but thing attached to it.
Yeah, I don't think we're unique in that, but we certainly seem to specialize in it, Scott, that there's always something that prevents us from doing the right thing in a timely way. And the Jamesville project certainly is one of those examples.
So what happens with this? Because this is an area that has been, how do you describe it? I mean, it's been a blight for a while. There's been potential there that nothing ever happens, but we go back to that word, like there's potential there.
Right. Not only an eyesore, but also a missed opportunity to put people in housing in an area that contained housing and people were removed from that area. So if you go back to the history, I mean, this was part of the land holding that Hamilton Housing had. So these were homes that were run by the city and were given the context as affordable as it gets in the downtown core. But they never were maintained appropriately because the province downloaded them to municipalities decades ago. Money wasn't put in to upkeep that stock. There were problems with asbestos and other issues. And so the last council had the right idea, I think, of seeing if the private market would be able to purchase those homes and utilize the land. And the city would then use the money that they were sold for to put into other housing projects. So it seemed to be a win-win situation all around. And a consortium of private developers came up with a plan, went to the city, they purchased those lots, they purchased all of those homes. The people that were living in them were asked to leave because work had to be done there. And then that's where the problems began because CN Rail, that has shunting yards all the way down to the harbor, where the stadium was going to be built so many years ago, and that's another story. But CN Rail yeah. decided, even when I was in the mayor's chair, and I actually had meetings with CN Rail, trying to get the shunting yards moved from that location because they occupy, for their business, which is a legitimate business, they occupy perhaps the best land in that area. It would be the most valuable land in that area. Right near the water would be very desirable for development. And I had meetings with CN Rail to try to move them out of there. But what they did, because they're still there and doing business there, they drew a big circle and they said anything that's going to draw attention or at least potential complaints because of redevelopment, we're going to appeal. That's what they've done. They've appealed because they think that those homes where people were living before, once reconstructed and redeveloped, may complain about the shunting yard noises and so on, which I personally don't think would happen, but that's what they've done. They've appealed and they've taken city through a process and held it up now for years. And if you drive by Jamesville, as many Hamiltonians I'm sure have done, not only have those properties deteriorated because they've essentially they're caged in and they've been left to the elements, but also they, you know, grasses are overgrown and, I mean, all of that stuff. And it's just a missed opportunity, which is a shame.
Let me throw, let's broaden this for just with the time we have left here, because one of the things that I think is happening with some of these projects is that, you know, we've just had this one very controversial in Stony Creek. And part of the point is there are people out there saying, well, why is it all, why is it here? Why can it not be in some other ward? Why is no other ward having to do what we're doing? Why have we not had every single councillor, because they all say there's a housing crisis, why have we not had every single councillor come to council with a piece of property publicly owned in their ward that they are ready to present and say, here we go, here is where we will build housing. I am giving my blessing to this. Let's get it going. Because it does seem like we always want to push it to some other part of the city, but not so much in our own backyard.
Yeah. Remember the tiny homes?
Yes, I do. Very well.
Was a hot potato, and those on council that were really supporting tiny homes then came out and said, yeah, but not in my area. I don't want them here. It seems that that there's always a stumbling block, and the first consideration maybe, unfortunately, is how will I look to my residents if I do this project in my area when in fact, that shouldn't be the case. So, I mean, that's a good point. In fact, I think that council has given the blessing to staff to come up with some suggestions, as you know, maybe councillors, especially the new ones, may not know every nuance in their own wards. So staff, professional staff, should come up with a list. But rather than surprising the councillor, as I think they did with the Stony Creek locations, rather than surprising them, involve the councillors in drawing up a list that then gets to the table. And I think that would then make it a smoother and an easier process. But in the meantime, as we broaden it out, and it should happen, you know, we still have this festering sore of Jamesville. And, you know, Scott, and I may be wrong about this, but I researched it some time ago, and I don't know whether facts have changed, but I found that the biggest shareholder for CN is none other than Bill Gates. Now, please
really?
Verify that.
Okay. I had no idea.
None other than Bill Gates. If I was sitting in the mayor's chair today, I'd be picking, if that's the case, I'd be picking up the phone and not working with the local CN folks. I would call the biggest shareholder, make him aware of these issues, and ask for his intervention. Because it seems to me that CN is dragging their feet purposely.
Okay, so I don't know. I will look that up. But if that's true, I would love to know if Bill Gates would answer a call from Andrea Horvath. But that's a different question for a different day down the road. That is Larry Deani, former mayor of the city. Thanks for this. Really appreciate the conversation.
All right, take care.
It's not that easy being green, having to spend each day the color of the leaves. When I think it could be nicer being red or yellow or gold or something much more colorful like that.
This is the image I have of how it's the last Timbit is going to sound when they play a musical about, well, the Tim Hortons-based musical. And I have this image of a large Timbit with legs on stage singing about life as the last Timbit in a box left behind. And the sadness that everyone enjoyed the chocolate dip and the honey glazed, but me as the old-fashioned plain just got abandoned and left to grow stale at the bottom of the box, maybe to finally be eaten by Rover when you need to give it away before it really turns badly. The last Timbit. It's true, though. There is a play about Tim Hortons. I'm going to bring in Alyssa Freeman, PR and pop culture expert. Alyssa, I don't know, when you hear of the last Timbit, what is the image of what kind of play is going to be featured?
Well, I do admit, Scott, that I did think of like dancing Timbits, you know, sort of sourdough, chocolate, the sprinkly kind, I don't know. But then I did a little bit of digging, and this play may actually have legs, not the kinds that you were talking about with Dancing Timbits. This is being produced by the same people who brought to you Come From Away.
Yes, yes.
Now, did you see that play?
I have not seen the play. I know very well about it. And just, I don't want to jump in. I want to keep going. But just to read what, so we've been joking about this, what the plot of this, the last Timbit, the production is loosely based on a 2010 snowstorm that was so bad, drivers on a highway east of Sarnia were forced to hunker down in cars and others and had to wait out the inclement weather at a local Tim Hortons. So yes, the Come From Away angle is very strong in this.
So I did see Come From Away, and I saw it when in its very early days, and I was blown away. Now, of course, this is a different sort of, it's not really a tragedy, but maybe slightly traumatic, that you're in a snowstorm and it's so bad that you have to pull off and be in the Tim's. And if you remember Come From Away or planes that were downed in Gander, Newfoundland, and everybody is about the story of people who came together while waiting out what was happening around 9/11 in a high school or a community center. So there are many parallels about people coming together and sharing stories. What's interesting about this is that, first of all, this has gotten so much media on every single platform that it has probably been one of Tim Horton's biggest, best, and most positive stories that they've ever had. I mean, it's been an avalanche of publicity, and nobody is saying anything bad about it. And I think that this play may actually be of interest because, A, it's by the same producers as Come From Away. B, it's steeped in Canadiana, telling Canadian stories of Canadians coming together. And C, everybody knows Tim Hortons. And what's interesting is that at a time when arts funding is under such fire, I mean, you know, the film festival, the International Film Festival, just recently lost Bell after 28 years of sponsorship, that here you have a corporate entity which is putting their muscle behind mounting a play that I think that would appeal to anybody from any walk of life. I'm just wondering if they're going to have a monopoly on the intermission snacks.
Oh, I have no doubt they will. even as you're talking about this and, you know, the most Canadian thing, I remember a number of years ago here on the radio, we were talking to the people behind Terry Fox, the musical. And at the time I thought, are you kidding? Like, how do you turn Terry Fox into like a that just sounds, but they did, they got it off the ground and it was Terry Fox, the musical, and it was very Canadian. I don't know ultimately how it did in the end. But you know, these things emerge every once in a while. And I guess some of them, like Come From Away, become massive international hits, and some of them, I don't know. I have a hard time imagining people are going to be able to wrap their heads past the Dancing Timbit idea, though. That's going to be a tough one to convince people that's not what it is.
Well, I think that comes down to how they deal with this narrative, how they promote the narrative. Now, remember, you have one of the most prolific, highest spending partners at Tim Hortons and their brand company that are going to be help promoting this play. So when you think about how much airtime Tim Hortons itself buys, all the ads you see on your phone, all the ads you see while while you're driving along the highway or in within the city, it is such a powerful promotional partner that they have this great opportunity to take this narrative, teach people what it's actually about getting together over coffee. In the middle of something that's also very Canadian, a snowstorm, not this past winter, but usually a snowstorm. So you've got this potentially compelling narrative of a play. You have a fantastic corporate sponsor who has the deep, deep pockets, not just to help mount the production, which is very costly, but then provide that extra added value in terms of helping promote the play at large. So normally it's up to the production itself to do all the promotion and hope that people come and see the play. However, when you have a partner like Tim's with that added layer on it, I mean, you know, the possibilities are endless. And plus they'll give away tickets and they'll do things in front of the theater while people are waiting in line. They'll hand out Timbits. I have to tell you, I think that this is, you know, from my perspective, in my business of doing PR and promotions, I think this is a great idea.
There is apparently going to be a touring production. It has to stop at Tim Hortons Field. I mean, they're like here in Hamilton, there's no way you could not stop at Tim Hortons Field with this story. I do wonder, and I think you're onto something though on one point for sure. If this works and if this is something that people latch on to, I do wonder if other companies will look at this and say, how do we, whether it's a TV show or a movie or a play, how do we, because, you know, we have product placement all the time. Here's, you're doing it backwards. Usually product placement is one little thing dropped into a movie or a TV show. Here you're doing the TV show dropped into the product placement. I think a lot of companies will look at this and if it works, say, we got to figure something out like that.
Well, if it does work and it does have a domino effect, Scott, this will have be a big boon to the struggling arts community, which so needs this type of sponsorship. And yes, product placement is nothing new. However, this is really reversing it and thinking about it out of the box, which I think that people may have thought of it as a joke, but nobody has ever actually tried to put it into place. So if you can think about the other permutations, you'll be sitting in Tim's having a coffee and suddenly there'll be a flash mob or whatever, the cast will pop up and start singing a song from the play. And the fact that there's a touring company, that's even more expensive. So they know this is a pan-Canadian brand from coast to coast to coast. There's nobody in Canada that really has not heard of Tim Hortons. They have taken a reputational hit over the past 3, 4, 5 years when they had a new parent company buy the brand. And the publicity around Tim's has not always been positive. In fact, they're dealing with something right now about telling, you know, hundreds or thousands of people that they want a boat. So, you know, this is a great way, in essence, to change the channel from that, in where you control the narrative, not just maybe of the, I don't think they have creative license over the play, but where you have, you can control the narrative of what you want to say about your product. And so really, it works on all levels.
And you know that it's going to be upbeat because all the songs are going to be in double time. Ba-boom!
Oh
yes,
my gosh, I've been trying to think of something so clever. You did it!
And I apologize to everyone for the worst pun joke of the day. That is Alyssa
Freeman. I was thinking about something with honey glaze, but I couldn't make it work.
Yeah, well, you know what song they have to get in here? Don't Be Crueler.
Oh my goodness. You're too quick.
Dave Woodard is about to bail out of the news update. Alyssa Freeman, thank you for doing this. So we're just talking about the Tim Hortons, the last Timbit play musical, which, you know, again, we've been having a lot of fun with it, but it sounds like it is not just a bunch of dancing Timbits, which, you know, could be the children's version of the production if you need to branch out to a larger audience. But I was, during the commercial break, I was just going, what are the worst musicals, the stupidest, most ill-conceived musicals that have ever seen the spotlight of a stage? These are real musicals. People prepared them, wrote them, learned them, performed them, not necessarily for a long time. Many of them did not last very long, understandably. And I can't even give you the complete list because so many of them are so perverse and gross that I can't even talk about them on the air. But I'll tell you some of them. These are real musicals that somebody thought were a good idea. And by the time I'm done this, I am reasonably confident everyone will say, by comparison, the last Timbit sounds genius. A Slender Man musical. Ever heard of Slender Man? It's a scary creature, kind of a ghoul, kind of a, you know, whatever. But yes, there was a play called the Slender Man musical. It stars a guy. Well, you know what? I can't even begin to explain the plot because for many of the reasons I said before, this devolves into some really weird, inappropriate stuff real fast. But, you know, there's that one. Silence, the musical. Now, you would think Silence musical, that sounds like an oxymoron. Yeah, if it was truly about silence, it would, in fact, be a difficult thing to do as a musical. But this was not silence, as in no sound. This was the musical version of Silence of the Lambs. Because nothing. When you watch the movie Silence of the Lambs, I know that everybody was sitting there going, you know what? This would translate into a great peppy musical on Broadway. You know, there's nothing that Silence of the Lambs makes you think of more than catchy show tunes. Especially when, you know, what's his name? The person starts skinning people and you've got, you know, Clarice with a lovely fava beans and some Chianti. Yeah, I don't even know how you sing that. Because when you sing, you're expelling air to sing. This is absorbing air. Anyway, the would be a tough one to do. Evil Dead, the musical. That would be this one got pretty good reviews, apparently, which is kind of shocking. Okay, here's what Raggedy Ann, the musical, ran on Broadway for 3 days. I'm not sure when. And if you're thinking, well, wait, Raggedy Ann, surely there's a lot of young girls from back in the day that would have loved Raggedy Ann, the musical. Yeah, not so much based on the description here. It's the story of a dying young girl with a Raggedy Ann doll who comes alive. They go on a mission to see a doctor in New York to save her life. And what ensues is a fever dream with themes of death, suicide, sex, and genocide. How do we go from Raggedy Ann, a little child doll, to that? No wonder 3 days was all it lasted on Broadway. All right, a few more here. This one's predictable. Scary, which is the musical version of Carrie, the Stephen King horror show. Scary. Okay. Another one that I just don't even, I can't begin to imagine who thought this was a good idea. It was called Moose Murders. This could be Canadian, like the last Timbit. This was described by a New York Times critic as seeing the show is comparable to surviving the Titanic. I can't even, again, begin to explain all the parts. The show featured a drug addict who was interested in doing obscene things with his mother, a daughter who tap danced at inappropriate times, and a mummified quadriplegic kicking a man in a moose costume in the groin. This one, it was described as perhaps the worst show ever on Broadway. Yeah, I could see that. Okay, we got two more really quickly. Via Galactica, 1972 musical, which was a set made up of trampolines and a background made of thousands of ping pong balls, lasted only 7 performances. The storyline, in which nonconformists living on an asteroid who kidnap a garbage man to seduce him to introduce his genes into their gene pool. It was highlighted by a number of technical snafus during its 7 episode run, actors falling through the trampoline, actors getting stuck in spaceships, and the microphone accidentally transmitting police radios during the performance, which is awesome. Let's see, one more. How about this one? Rockabye Hamlet. Absolutely, it was a true thing. It was a rock musical based on a Shakespeare play. Nothing like having Shakespeare turned into a rock opera. That is, there you go. So you know what? Maybe The Last Timbit, by comparison, is going to be absolutely what everyone is lining up to see. There you go. We are out of time. There are more, but as I say, I can't share them with you because CRTC regulations prevent such things. It's amazing the filth that people put on Broadway. Anyway, thanks for being here today. Glad you were able to join us. Tom did an amazing job on the board today. Thank you to Tom. Will, great show that he lined up. All of our amazing guests, thank you for joining us. And to you for listening, we do very much appreciate you taking time to join us today. Scott Thompson, the original Scott, the other Scott, he is back tomorrow at 3:00. Tune in then. We'll see you. Have a great evening.